just acknowledged and thanked God for the blessings of our lives, I'm going to tell you you're about to experience another. Our extraordinary scholar, activist, and residence, Rabbi Jonah Pesner, my wonderful colleague and friend. And I'm going to introduce him in just a moment. But first, a few very important thank yous. As many of you know, year after year, our scholar in residence program is made possible by the Betty and Jack Bader Adult Education Fund. Betty and Jack were the beloved parents of our past president, Gloria Mizell, and the Mahatonim of another of our past presidents, Dr. Barry Mizell. Barry is here, Gloria is a bit under the weather. But 24 years ago, when Barry, an OBGYN, became one of our reform movement's first trained mohalim, he established this special fund in Betty and Jack's memory. And for every bris that he performs, a contribution is made to the Bader Fund. So we thank Barry and in absentia Gloria and wish her to get well soon. And we're so grateful to them for making this weekend, this very exciting weekend, possible. I also want to thank our executive director, Jennifer Kelly, who oversaw many of the logistics for the days to come. Especially, I want to thank Rabbi Jeff Middleman and our extraordinary planning committee of the Tikkun Olam Council. For months now, Susan Pecker, Sheila Schneiderman, Karen Silver, Tracy Stein, Nona Ullman, and their tireless chair, Maxine Olson Maynard, have been sketching out the details of these 3 days, which kick off our involvement in Reform Judaism's Just Congregations Initiative, of which Rabbi Middleman spoke so wonderfully on Yom Kippur. The Just Congregations program links synagogues with other houses of worship in common cause to address issues which matter to us individually and as members of a wider community. Our honored guest, my dear friend and rabbinic school classmate, Rabbi Jonah Dove Pesner, is the founding director of this initiative. It grew really very much out of his passion and has taken root across our movement. Rabbi Pesner travels extensively. In fact, he just returned from California very, very early this morning. He travels to work with synagogues around the country and to teach on all three campuses of our Reform Movement's seminary, the Hebrew Union College. He's guided congregations and organizations in successful campaigns for healthcare access, affordable housing, public education, gay and lesbian rights, workers' rights, and a living wage. As a leader of the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, Rabbi Pesner was the chair of the GBIO effort in the Massachusetts Affordable Care Today Coalition, which successfully secured health care for more than 500,000 uninsured residents of the state of Massachusetts. He currently chairs the board of the Jewish Organization Initiative and has served on the boards of the Central Conference of American Rabbis and the Jewish Memorial Hospital in Roxbury. He's written several journal articles and wrote a chapter entitled Redemption for Radicals in the anthology Righteous Indignation. A graduate of Wesleyan, Rabbi Pesner was ordained from HUC in 1997, where he was selected as the Meyer W. Nathan Scholar. His first position was as assistant rabbi at Temple Israel in Westport, and then he was called north to become associate rabbi at Temple Israel of Boston. He's married to attorney Dana Gershon, and they have 4 daughters, Juliet, Noah, Bobby, and Kate. Rabbi Pesner's visit opens not just another conversation in our congregation, but rather what we're calling a conversation for change. As we will learn throughout the course of this weekend, congregation-based community organizing begins with interested members of a congregation having the opportunity to articulate those societal concerns which they feel most personally and passionately, and culminates in gathering together these members and those of many other congregations into one organized whole with the power to make a real difference. It is what Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel called praying with your feet, what Rabbi Alexander Schindler called applied Judaism, a grassroots effort to act on our religious values in society in a manner which addresses our own very personal concerns. Our congregation is one of 50 in Westchester committed to taking this journey. They include some of our own Christian neighbors here in Chappaqua, as well as many congregations throughout the county. So this is going to be a working weekend for us as we explore an exciting opportunity to share the issues which touch us personally, and through those conversations get to know one another a bit better, and ultimately to consider the prospects for impacting public policy. Tomorrow morning at 9:15 during Torah study, Rabbi Pester's topic will be Finding Redemption from Noah to Babel and Beyond. At 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by representatives of the First Congregational Church and the Church of St. Mary the Virgin for a program titled Building the Power to Repair the World, an exploration of congregation-based community organizing with our interfaith partners. Excuse me. And on Sunday morning at 10:30 during religious school, Rabbi Pester will teach us how kids and parents can change the world, an exploration of community organizing within religious education, and babysitting will be available. But to kick things off tonight, his theme will be Becoming a Just Congregation, Creating Relationships, Building Power, Repairing the World. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great privilege to invite to this pulpit my wonderful friend and colleague, and truly an inspiration to our movement, Rabbi Jonah Pester.
Shabbat Shalom.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Excellent, excellent. Well, first of all, thank you, Rabbi Davidson. I've known Rabbi Davidson since we... Is that too loud now?
Yes.
Yeah, let's lower that. Is that a little bit better? Okay. I've known Rabbi Davidson since we both showed up the first day of school. Not nursery school, though it felt that way sometimes. Not high school, probably felt more like that other times. But rabbinical school. As we ride into Jerusalem, I have to tell you, we were sharing earlier some memories. We had the biggest class in the history of Hebrew Union College, and it was a great class. We have some true superstars. Rabbis who are now serving pulpits across the country and in various institutional roles. But even on that first day, we all knew what you know, which is that Rabbi Joshua Davidson is a superstar. We were kids, and yet there was one of us who was articulate and poised and mature. We sometimes thought he was born in that suit. And he modeled for us all what it would be like to actually imagine ourselves as adults who could speak articulately and intelligently and lead congregations. So I don't know if you know this, Josh, but you have always been a role model to me, a kind brother that I want to be, and to have been invited by you to be your scholar and activist in residence is just full of meaning. I want to echo my thanks to Barry Mizell and to your family, the Baders, for the fund that you set up to enable visits like mine. Of course, I want to also acknowledge your clergy colleagues, Jeff and Dana, for having me share this pulpit with you tonight, and to Bill and Maria for a lovely Shabbat dinner and for your leadership in this institution and the way that you not only lead but also model serious adult Jewish engagement. I'm very much appreciative. I also want to thank, I think, the most important person here tonight, Madeline, for inviting me to your bat mitzvah. You had no idea. Don't worry, Mom, I don't have to set an extra plate. I'll find lunch elsewhere. So my job tonight is simply to share three short stories and make an invitation. Three short stories and make an invitation. Hopefully the stories may stir, move, evoke something inside of you, and as a result, I'll make an invitation to those of you who are moved, who are stirred, about some ways that you can explore locating yourself in the stories that I tell you tonight and moving forward with your rabbis and your cantor and your community and your tikkun olam council as they move you forward. And over the course of the weekend, I look forward to working with lots of you, but in particular the tikkun olam council, who not only put tonight together and the whole weekend together, but have offered to help me run parts of what's going to happen tomorrow and Sunday. So the stories. The first is an ancient story from our tradition that's about all of us, because it's a story of the Jews. The second is a small story just about me to help you understand why I care so much about the work that I'm going to describe. And the third story is a story of a community like ours today. So an ancient story, a personal story, and a story of today. So I begin with the ancient story. Now, when I was a kid in youth group, growing up, as I did in New York City, and by the way, let's not underestimate how important it is to be home. I grew up in Manhattan, and I spent the first 30 years of my life, and then I was exiled to Boston. And as the ancient Israelites wept on the banks of the Babylon, crying over their exile, I too sat by the Charles for 10 years among Red Sox fans, yearning to back in the rows. But that literally came true when I flew on the red eye home from Los Angeles to Boston, as everybody on that plane was rooting for the wrong team just because they didn't want the right team to have won. And as we got score updates, it only went from bad to worse. So indeed, as I grew up in youth group, in my synagogue in Greenwich Village, I heard again and again wonderful stories of the ways in which our people focused on Zichron Olam, the way in which social justice was so much a part of our narrative and a principle of Reform Judaism. And as I was encouraged as a young, nifty leader to be a hero for tzedakah, for justice, and for tikkun, for repair, I often was told the story of Nachshon. Now, how do you know Nachshon? Okay? Nachshon, one of the great heroes of Jewish tradition, because perhaps the most important moment of redemption, the most important transformation of a people enslaved to a people who become free, the transformation of the world that it is parched with oppression, parched with injustice, to a world overflowing with justice, a people moving from slavery in Egypt to freedom in the Promised Land. There's only one thing blocking them on their journey, and that is the sea. With the Egyptians behind them and the sea of reeds in front of them, the Israelites stand at the sea crying out to God, "What shall we do?" And in the Midrash about this narrative, we hear about Nachshon. Now let me rest assured to those of you who wonder if I'm in the wrong Torah portion. Madeline, don't worry. You can practice Noah, right? You can go. Good. Tomorrow morning, we'll study Noah. Tonight, a moment of the Exodus as the master story of justice in our tradition. So what does Nachshon do? Who remembers? What does Nachshon do? Exactly. He actually was fulfilled the obligation to teach the child to swim. He did what? The Israelites are standing on the shore of the sea, sure that their future is to drown or be murdered by the Egyptians, and Nachshon has the faith that if he jumps in the water, he might swim, or the water would part. And the rabbis teach this midrash that says the waters began to part at the courage of Nachshon, who jumped in, who took a risk, who put his life on the line in faith that God would rescue the Israelites. And I always was taught that midrash as a way to say, be courageous, act for justice, and the waters will part. But as I've grown and evolved, I heard words like the prayer that we pray tonight. We prayed a prayer tonight before we sang the Michamocha, which is, of course, the song that the Israelites sang as they crossed the sea, in celebration of the justice that they had received. The prayer that we read was that the waters only part when a group of people join hands and start marching together. Do you remember that prayer that we read? It's a good one. So I discovered, as I became a community organizer through my synagogue life as a rabbi, a story that I'll tell in a minute with the personal story, that there is another midrash right next to the midrash of Nachshon, which is not often taught in Nifty. It's not often taught in youth group. It's not often told in Hebrew school. And that is, and it's framed with the words devar acher, right? Which means another interpretation. Another interpretation, said the rabbis, was that the water only parted when every Israelite man, woman, and child joined hands and entered the water together. That's a midrash that is not about the courage and the risk of a single heroic individual. It's rather a teaching about the power of the collective, of the group. There was only when God realized all Israel stood together, ready to stand down in justice, that the waters could part. So now a modern story, and a personal one, about me, and how I learned the importance, the centrality of the shift of Midrash from Nachshon to the collective. So as I told you, I grew up in Greenwich Village, 10th Street and University Place. Okay? We're in Chappaqua, so people know New York now. Okay? So, I went to New York City Public Schools. Any New York City Public School products?
Thank you.
Okay, all right. So for those of you that know the New York City public schools, having grown up on Kent State University Place, what would have been the logical high school for me to go to?
Steinstein.
I love the hometown crowd. I'm in L.A., and I'm telling the story, and I'm getting blank stares. What's he talking about, they're saying. So thank you for that. So I should have gone to Bronx Science, but I didn't get in. And so I went to... Oh, did I just give it away? Should have gone to Stuyvesant, but I didn't get it, so I went to the Bronx High School of Science, a great school. Any Bronx Science alums? Sometimes when I tell them, sorry, I find somebody who went. Okay. So I didn't get into Stuyvesant, so I wound up in the Bronx High School of Science. Great school, big problem. How do you get from Temple University to 205th and Bedford Park Boulevard?
The D train.
The D train. Thank you very much. I'm so glad you came tonight for so many reasons. That would have been as smart as going to Stuyvesant. I actually took the 4 train every day. Now we can get into a conversation about the merits of the 4 train versus the merits of the D train. But the D was delayed a lot. The 4 was a little bit faster, so I wound up taking the 4 train. Okay. So I got to share with you that the synagogue that I grew up on 12th Street University Place, the Village Temple, was absolutely the most important institution of my life for my entire childhood. My father was the temple president, I was the youth group president, my mother was on the board, my brother was active. It was the kind of place that everybody knew one another and cared for one another. And in the same ways that you lifted up earlier, who is ill and broken in our community here and who is celebrating, it was like that kind of place. And when I was 14 years old, my father died suddenly of a heart attack. And the Village Temple taught me what it means to be a just community. They surrounded my mother and my brother and I with love and support and nurture and care. So I took very seriously the values of that institution and what it embodied, and my experience of those values, the way I was cared for as a kid. And when I heard time and again the sermonic, prophetic voice of social and economic justice from the Bema, I took it seriously. And my friends and I, Nifty, we would go to the soup kitchens and we would do whatever the campaigns for justice, we would march on the mall in Washington to free Soviet Jews, because we felt called by our synagogue. In the same way that we were called to care for one another, we were cared to, as Rabbi Middleman said, look outside the walls of the synagogue and see the injustices that were around us. And here's where things got very, very agitational for me. My lived experience was of an insular, loving, caring community that was engaged with the world outside its doors. And from the time I was 14 years old, I would get up at 6 o'clock every morning and walk to Union Square and get on the 4 train. And I would ride the 4 train all the way up to 205th Street. And what did I see in between? Well, yeah, Yankee Stadium, for sure. What's the neighborhood like around Yankee? This is the early 1980s. Okay. So at 86th Street, all the white people used to get off. And all the black folks would get on. And at 125th Street, I would start to get nervous. And people would get on the train, and I would keep my eyes like this. And I was hearing from the pulpit social and economic justice, and civil rights, and racial equality. And then I would ride that 4 train for 4 years. And the train would come up at 161st Street, at Yankee Stadium, and I would look outside the windows, and I would look down into those neighborhoods, and I could not imagine that people lived in those buildings, that people played in those parks, that people walked on those streets. And then the doors would open, and people would get on. And I would duck my eyes. And I felt scared at times, and any of you who have spent any time in New York City, especially in this period that I'm describing, the early 80s, I would be nervous that the train would break down, lest I have to get off and walk around that neighborhood. And I was ashamed, and I felt powerless. I graduated, I left the Bronx, I never went back. I became an assistant rabbi at a major congregation in Boston, still with all the values of social and economic justice that I had grown up with, wanting to do good in the world, still agitated by that experience, though never having really processed it or unpacked it. And we became involved in an interfaith group called the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, which is a sister organization to some interfaith groups in New York City. And it had been formed by a collection of churches and synagogues that wanted to make Boston a better place. by building powerful relationships that could bring together stakeholders to make the city of Boston, Greater Boston, better. And over a few meetings and a few sessions, I started to hear about this thing called community organizing, and they were doing some very interesting work around public schools and getting more textbooks in the schools, and they were doing some good work around affordable housing. And I started getting involved, and I didn't really get what was going on. It was very confusing when they kept explaining it to me, but I liked the people, and it was very diverse. There were black preachers, and there were Catholic priests, and there were... So it seemed interesting, so I kept going. And I got to know a guy named Reverend John Heinemeier. Now here's what you have to know about Reverend Heinemeier. 6'4" from Waco, Texas, Lutheran pastor. The only white minister ever to be made a member of the Black Ministerial Alliance of Boston. Because he served a church called Resurrection Lutheran in Roxbury. And if you don't know Boston, it's like, you know, East New York or the South Bronx. Okay? All black neighborhood. He's the only white guy living in the neighborhood. And he served that church as an intercity church because that was his calling. And he came to meet with me after getting to know me a little bit. And he wanted to have a relational meeting with me. And I'm saying, a relational meeting? What are you talking about? He said, well, I'll tell you some stories about me. You tell me some stories about you. We'll see if, you know, we want to... It's like, am I going to, like, you know, not like this? You know, what is this? I said, all right, he's a decent guy, interesting type. So he asked me about myself. And I started telling him what it was like to take that four train every day. You know, he wanted to know why I cared so deeply about social justice. And I would tell him what it was like to grow up, you know, taking that subway train. And he was clearly engaged. And he shared with me that he had actually been a pastor in the South Bronx for many years. And he said, you know, when we were in the South Bronx, we were part of something called South Bronx Churches, which was a collection of religious organizations and other institutions that worked together. And after I got to know John, and we got to trust each other, he made an invitation to me. We were just at the point of the synagogue where we were trying to decide, are we really going to get deeply involved in this Greater Boston Interfaith Organization? Are we really going to sort of roll up our sleeves, join hands, and march with these people? And he said, would you bring a group of rabbis and a group of funders from the Jewish community and sort of the power players to the South Bronx to see some of the work we did there when I was in South Bronx Church? And I said to him, John, you know, you've heard me tell my story about, you know, the four train. I left. I never really wanted to go back. And he said, you need to go back. You need to see the change is possible. You need to see what's happening. And we organized a group. We flew into LaGuardia. We had a van to take this group of rabbis and other leaders of Combined Jewish Philanthropies, which is our federation. And the van brought us into the South Bronx. And my heart, you know, was starting to palpitate. Some of my fear as a kid and worried about what kind of experiences I was going to have. And the van pulls up and the doors open wide and I step out and I look around and it took my breath away. Because there were rows and rows of beautiful, freshly painted two-family row houses. Little gardens in the front, and stoops with people sitting on them, and children safely playing in the street. Those neighborhoods that I had looked down from and seen barren, crack fields, burnt out buildings, empty lots had been transformed into a neighborhood that was alive. Called Nehemiah Homes. And as a parenthetical side note, Nehemiah Homes made it back into the news widely in the last 6 months or so because of the foreclosure crisis. Nehemiah Homes has had almost a 0% foreclosure crisis. Because the folks who helped build these homes were stakeholders. They were invested in the process of building them. So I turned to Reverend Heinemeier, standing there with my breath taken away, and I said, Reverend Heinemeier, how did you do this? I gotta know. And then he taught me an incredible Torah. He said to me, Jonah, I didn't do this. We did this. The pastors and the priests and the ministers and our congregants, our folks in our pews, thousands and thousands of people from the South Bronx joined hands together. And we reached out to the mayor and his administration. And we reached out to the banks. And we got the land for this housing. and we got mortgages for the folks, and we did training programs on moving from debt to assets so people could understand home ownership. And we worked with the developers, and we built these tens of thousands of units. We did it. And suddenly I got it. All along I thought my job was to be like Nachshon. And the powerlessness that I felt riding the four train was that I couldn't do anything. And then I realized what John was teaching me was it's not that I couldn't do anything, it's that I was powerless to do anything alone. Great change happens when we reach out and join hands and we all part the seas together. So the last story, and with this I'll bring it to a close. So over the course of the time that I spent in the Boston area as a rabbi involved in the Boston version of this interfaith group called the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, we did, in fact, become very much an engaged congregation, the congregation where I was the assistant rabbi, and started our community organizing. And something I need to share with you about how this all works is the work that we do in the world doesn't start with an issue or an agenda. It doesn't come from the top down. Reverend Heinemeier did not pick housing construction as his issue. The way this work starts is through lots and lots of one-on-one conversations, lots of relational meetings like I described I was having with Reverend Heinemeier, lots of house meetings where folks share the stories of their lives with one another, they talk to each other about their values and their stories and the history of their families and their commitments and their concerns and the things that are broken in their neighborhoods and in their lives and in their institutions. And it was out of those conversations that the folks of the South Bronx articulated the gap between the world as it should be, where there was decent housing in their stable neighborhood, and the world as it is, a neighborhood broken with crime and destruction. And together they realized they had a shared story. So the synagogue that I was with went through what we call a relationship building campaign. Now rumor has it that there is a capital campaign happening in this congregation, right? Is that right? Okay. Right. Maybe some of the good people in this room have been part of this campaign. Raise your hand if you've been part of this campaign. Oh, don't be shy. All right. A capital campaign is where people get together, one-on-one conversations, to talk about what they dream and imagine about for their synagogue. And then together they build it by all contributing something, right? A relationship building campaign is just the same thing, only you don't have to pay. You share your dreams, your visions, your aspirations for your community, and then collectively decide, what kind of community are we going to build? How will we transform our neighborhood? So at house meetings in my own congregation, which is not so dissimilar from this one, people told lots of stories about the things that were broken in their world. They told stories about their experiences of a broken healthcare system. They talked about pressures of the public schools. Lots of different things emerged, and lots of different actions and activities came out of these different stories, but there was one moment in time where the single most common story that we heard was the following. And see if this resonates with either stories that you've heard or even feelings that you've had. People would say, my life is basically good, I have a good job, I have a good home, I'm raising kids, I'm busy all the time between work and home and getting kids here and there. But the one thing that I feel pressure in my life, as my parents age, I can't do for them, I can't be with them, I can't support them the way that I would want. And we began to hear a real widespread shared frustration. We heard stories like a story by a woman who said, I went to go visit my mother in an assisted living facility, and I already feel guilty that I can only get there once a week because I'm so busy. And I get her to this seemingly great institution, and I'm paying a lot of money for her to be there. And I already feel guilty enough that I can't care for her in my own home, and I show up, and I found her lying in her own urine. She had never told this story in public. She had never shared with the people that she prays with on Friday, that she studies with on Saturday, who are raising kids in our Sunday school, that that's what's really on her mind. That's what's broken in the world that she experiences. And as she began to hear other people tell the stories about their frustrations with nursing homes and assisted living facilities and home healthcare workers, there was a recognition that this was a deep and widespread story in our congregation. And what we needed to do was join hands and start marching together around the very deep concern about caring for our aging parents and grandparents and loved ones. But here's where the story gets really interesting. This one synagogue was not alone. Right? Remember South Bronx churches? Remember Greater Boston Interfaith Organization? So it was a partner with 49 other religious institutions across Greater Boston that were also doing house meetings and sharing individual stories and having one-on-one conversations to try and lift up the concerns that were in our community. And of the 50 institutions, there was a real significant number, like 6 or 7, that were Haitian churches. Haitian churches, the fastest growing immigrant group in the Greater Boston area. And in a minute, you'll see why this matters. In the Haitian churches, they're also having their house meetings, their one-on-ones, and sharing their stories of frustration. And this is the widespread story that begins to come out of those institutions. We came to this country to make a better life for our children and our grandchildren. And we arrive in this country, and because we are undereducated, the only work that we can be given is as certified nursing assistants and home health care aides, frontline nursing assistants in assisted living facilities and nursing homes. And we take these jobs because back in Haiti, it's a cultural norm to care for your own frail elderly in your home. So we're good at it, and we do it as our sacred duty, but because it's the most disrespected, low-wage job on the totem pole, we're overworked, we're underpaid, we're disrespected in the workplace, and who suffers? The frail elders who we are trying to care for. And all of a sudden, there's a recognition that joining hands and marching together doesn't just mean with folks in the synagogue. It means with the Haitian workers on the other side of town, with whom we have a shared narrative, both in our values and the brokenness of the world in which we live. And teams from the Haitian churches and from the Jewish synagogues and some of the other churches get together to share common stories. And there begins to become a recognition that one of the ways the nursing care industry in Massachusetts was saving money was with their staffing ratios. One certified nursing assistant for 20, 30 patients or residents. So that it wasn't a surprise that when Fran showed up, her mother was lying in her own urine because there weren't enough staff to take care of her mother. And things began to change as there was a recognition of shared concern. So these teams, and you got to imagine this interfaith organization. So you have Haitian Christians, you have Jewish folks, you have African-American Christians, you have Latino Catholics working together, talking through this issue, beginning to form research teams to go around into the neighborhoods and the communities to start to figure out what can we do about this issue. And together they collectively draft a statement of principles. The world as it should be inside of a nursing home. The world as it ought to be inside of an assisted living facility. The way it ought to be for residents. The way it ought to be for workers. And together they start meeting with folks in the neighborhood of the different institutions, the assisted living facilities. And they ask the neighbors who live in the area, do you know what's going on? Do you care what happens? And it turns out people in the neighborhoods actually do care how patients and residents are treated in these facilities. And then the team started meeting with the folks in the local papers, the Newton Tab, and the Brookline Press, and the Bay State Banner, and asking, do you know the stories of what's coming out of some of the nursing homes and some of the assisted living facilities? And the members of the press corps were actually quite interested. And then together, these teams of Latinos and Haitians and Jews and Christians together make appointments to go see the managers of the nursing homes with their statement of principles about decency. And they go and they say, we would like to ask you to ratify and stand with us in affirming this statement of decency and principles for our nursing homes, the way our elders and our workers will be treated. And by the way, the team said, we're confident that you'll join us because the press is waiting outside. And they would like to take a picture of you standing with us. And things began to change inside the nursing home. As the managers recognized that there were constituents, that there were residents, that there were workers, that there were the families, that there were the neighbors who cared, that there were rabbis and priests and ministers who cared what went on. And here's where the story culminates and gets really interesting. The research teams met with the president of my congregation at the time. I won't do that again. I'm getting into that. It happened that the president of the synagogue that employed me was also the chief of staff of the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And the chief of staff said, yeah, this is great. I'm going to refer you to our civil rights director. I suspect that there are some violations by the industry here, and the Attorney General ought to take a look at this. So the civil rights division says, oh, this is great. There's actually some real significant violations of Massachusetts state law here. All we need to do is get the Attorney General to issue a clarification of law to the nursing care industry, and that'll put some pressure and things will begin to change. Great, he said. When can we count on the Attorney General to issue that statement? And we waited. And we waited. And we waited. And we got nothing. Now this was strange. And by the way, just as full disclosure, this work is not partisan. It's political, and that it engages in public life. And we talk to politicians, we talk to elected leaders, but never is there any partisan endorsement of anybody. In this case, the Attorney General happened to be a Democrat. And as we were trying to figure out why it was that he wasn't answering our phone calls anymore, he was also running in the primary for governor of Massachusetts. Now, can you guess why he stopped talking to us? Huge. And it was no longer in his interest.
Could you repeat what you said?
Absolutely. You want to say it in a louder voice? The nursing care industry was pouring money into his gubernatorial campaign. So he made a political calculation. Let's make him think this is partisan. This is a guy, very decent guy, who has the label of a progressive Democrat. So this is truly not about partisanship. This is about political reality. Attorney General Riley had the nursing care industry supporting his campaign with lots of campaign contributions. And then he had a bunch of faith people on the other side. So for months, we negotiated with his campaign, trying to get him to move on this and give us this public affirmation. By the way, not to change Massachusetts law. Not to prosecute anybody. Just to make a clear statement of what the law was. And we got nothing. So finally, we said to the campaign, okay, if the Attorney General won't issue this advisory this way, here's what we're going to do. We're going to meet at Temple Salem of Dorchester. Temple Salem is one of the most powerful, important Haitian churches, which used to be Temple Shalom. You get a Temple Salem, Temple Shalom? It was an Orthodox synagogue in the day when that was a Jewish neighborhood. And we're going to fill Temple Salem with 500 people, 100 Jews, 100 Haitians, and 300 other African-American Christians, Latino Catholics, the whole mix of Greater Boston. We represent 25% of all the voting districts in Massachusetts. We're going to fill that room, and we're going to have the rabbis and the ministers and the priests, and we're going to have the folks whose families are in these institutions, and we're going to have the press. And we invite you to come to us and say no to our face. Well, we're, you know, very connected to the Attorney General, both of the chief of staff who's a member of my synagogue and a good friend of his who's the pastor of a prominent church in Boston. Attorney General Riley said, look, I'll come to your meeting, but I'm not going to do what you want me to do. I'll talk to your folks. I'll tell them how complicated this is, but I'm not going to do what you want me to do. At 6:30 that night for a 7 o'clock meeting, the place packed, the press standing in the back, electric atmosphere in the room. The staff still said, the Attorney General will not do what you want. And at 7 o'clock sharp, in a room like this one, the meeting begins. It begins with an opening prayer, one in Haitian Creole, one in Hebrew, one in English. And we sing opening songs. And there is this sort of electricity as people are singing and swaying together. And the Attorney General and the staff are sitting in the front row like this. And then one after the other, the folks in our institutions get up to tell the stories. The stories of their experience. The woman in my synagogue got up and publicly testified about the story about finding her mother in her own urine. The workers putting their own jobs at risk got up and talked about the conditions inside the nursing homes and the assisted living facilities. And the temperature levels started to rise as people were moved and engaged by these stories. And then an elder from the Haitian church got up at the platform and said, and now, Attorney General Riley, you have heard our platform. You have heard our stories, and we are going to ask you this night, will you issue an advisory here in front of the press to the nursing care industry, clarifying the workplace rules and laws inside of nursing homes and assisted living facilities? You could have cut the tension with a knife. Attorney General Riley gets up to the microphone, and he looks around the room, and he says, let me tell you about my mother. My mother was an immigrant to this country from Ireland. when she showed up in Boston, she was met with the sign, Irish need not apply. And the only job that she could get was scrubbing floors. And she would come home at night, her fingers raw to the bone, exhausted and beaten down. And he said, I went into public life to fight for people like my mom. And then he looked into the eyes of the mostly women Haitian nursing care workers. And he said, when I look into your eyes, I see my own mother. And tomorrow I will issue an advisory to the nursing care industry. We're going to start enforcing workplace rules. And we're going to make sure that the nursing homes and the assisted living facilities operate within the values and the laws of Massachusetts. And the world changed. It changed for workers, and it changed for the members of my congregation who had been standing with the water in front of them, waiting and praying for the seat of pardon, and then realizing by joining hands together, not just with one another, but with the African-American Christians and the Haitians and the Latinos, together, they can part the waters. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.